Hey, John.
Hey, Nick.
So today's episode is not funny.
Right.
It's what some might refer to as the opposite of funny.
Yeah, like unfunny.
Right. And so we thought before we get into the episode, we should maybe just like get a joke out of the way.
Yeah,
there's
just
not
like,
going to be a lot of jokes during the episode.
Yeah, we have a quota.
Yeah.
So we got to make sure we get one and done.
At least one joke.
Right. Did you have something?
I have a joke.
Okay.
What do you call a dinosaur that gets into a car crash?
I don't know.
Tyrannosaurus Rex. Get it? Do you get it?
Yeah.
How about your joke?
I think that made me sad. Well, I was gonna ask if you heard about the corduroy pillow.
Oh, it's making headlines.
Yeah, that's my go-to.
Well,
here we go.
This is Stranger Still. Welcome to Stranger Still.
It's a podcast where we answer strange questions you never thought to ask.
And I'm Nick Wood.
I'm John Began.
And with us today is... Oh, I should have said his name.
No, he could say it.
Oh, okay.
Oh, I'm Maddie Rendulik. Nice to be with you all.
Look at that. That's the help yourself of introductions.
Thanks. Thanks Please. For joining us. Do you want to be called Matt, Maddie, or Matthew?
Oh, Maddie is fine. And yeah, it's my pleasure to be here.
Perfect. Cool. Do you want to give a quick introduction of why you feel you're on this podcast?
Well, I was winning some kind of contest, right? This is, I'm going to get like beef stroganoff or something years. Or
I think we tricked him into this one. We did.
Oh,
tell
no.
Him
is
that. No, Matt. We gave you that after. That's after.
You know, this actually, that's a similar way that I was sent to reparative therapy by my parents. So the same kind of trick. So
yeah. Here we go. We're tying it together.
Yeah. Perfect. No, I'm here because, you know, obviously you guys are going to be talking about reparative or conversion therapy,
mm-hmm.
Which is something that I had experienced as a young man growing up. I'm also a member of the clergy, so I still counsel a lot of people that unfortunately kind of still see this in their own lives. And I'm kind of an LGBTQ advocate amongst mainline and even some more progressive evangelical denominations.
Perfect.
Heck
that was a perfect introduction. So like Maddie said, we're covering conversion therapy today. And like we said in the intro, it's not going to be super funny, but it's Pride Month and we want to do our part as best as we can.
Yeah, to be a good ally, you just have to listen for the most part, right? And so that's why we got you on. And beyond that, Pride Month isn't only about, from what I understand, celebrating LGBTQIA plus culture. It's about the pain that people experience and recognizing that.
So two things up top real fast is that if you haven't listened to last week's episode on cognitive disassociation, please go listen to that, because if you have any barriers about anything in the LGBTQ community, hopefully that episode will help you break down those walls. And second of all, if you ever need to talk to someone about anything, and this is kind of a shameless plug and honesty, you can go to our Facebook page.
Yeah.
And if you just want to... If you need help, there's a ton of people in that group that are loving and not judgy and would be happy to be there for you.
And that is a 100% certified fresh guarantee, because we kick out all the butt.
Yeah,
buttheads.
If there's any buttheads, they get kicked right out.
Yep, it's a closed group.
Conversion therapy. Do you know the history of conversion therapy, Maddie?
Well, I mean, I know many of the names and such. I would say that it's probably been around officially since the turning of the tide in the psychological analysts and statistics manual back in the early 70s. That's when homosexuality was taken out as a disorder, and there have still been some older school clinical psychologists that believe that, you know, it still is a disorder and that you can change that through cognitive behavioral changes. So And that tends to line up with some more fundamentalist and literalist faith groups as well. So it's old science, and it's it's not new, but it's stuck around. And unfortunately, it's still around today. I mean, we in Pennsylvania, we just delivered a some laws and some languages to the Capitol, a group that I'm proud to – I don't necessarily work with them, but they're just great representatives of the LGBT community. And
the good fight.
Yeah, it's called the Pennsylvania Equality Project, and they are doing a great job of getting awareness out of what this therapy is, what it means to people in today's context, and just how damaging it can be as well.
Yeah, this whole idea of conversion therapy has been around for, I think, around 80 years. It kind of started even before it was taken out of the DSM. For being a disorder. Before that, they did think it was a disorder. That's why it was in there, and that's when sort of this idea of the conversion therapy came around. I would say it was around the early 1900s when Sigmund Freud was around. He was one of the first people to start trying it, because it did start, like, it is called therapy, and it started as what we traditionally know as therapy, where you'd sit down with someone, a psychologist, and they'd try to talk it out with you, like you would do with depression, or what else do people go to therapy for? Family issues or whatever. It started out like that.
Now, if I do not like girls, they would say, and they'd be like, because I'm a normal human, and they'd be like, no, could you love your mother?
Well, actually, this was surprising to me, is that Sigmund Freud actually turned on it when he realized that this therapy wasn't working. And unfortunately, also like Matt said, is people didn't believe him, and they just kept running with it. Like, yeah, of course we can cure homosexuality through therapy. And they got frustrated, and they stepped up into what I would call non-therapeutic measures and kept the same name. They went through like electroshock therapy. We did that to like everyone that we thought was had a mental disorder back then. They would apply electroshock therapy to people's genitals. They did chemical castration. In the very early times, they did ice pick lobotomies, just because like you take out pieces of brains and they're not gonna think the way they did before. They're just gonna be a potato anyway.
Sure. Yeah.
You no longer have part of your brain. They also did masturbatory reconditioning. Trying to recondition your masturbatory habits.
Which at first sounds kind of fun, but...
Yeah.
Probably. Like, isn't like that.
You have to masturbate a lot. Oh, okay. Please, no.
Well, what they would do is, I think this might have been with the masturbatory stuff, but they would give patients vomit-inducing drugs and show them homoerotic pictures, or paralyze them and like show them videos of... homosexuality, I guess.
Yeah.
And so they would associate it with vomiting, and they wouldn't like it anymore. They'd feel sick every time they saw it. It's like in Clockwork Orange.
Sure.
Except a little bit.
And although this wasn't my personal experience, I have heard of groups even today that basically only they'll do similar things. They'll show what they'll call homosexual propaganda or something like that.
Yeah.
And it'll be. Rape or violent based, and you know they'll already have worn the patients down to such an emotionally raw state where there's so much shame, and then when they keep showing them this stuff, you know, it just creates these, you know, just hideous feelings and associations and everything that the patients themselves have. So that even goes on today.
Shame
from what I've heard, you know.
Yeah, shame is one thing that comes up a lot when I was researching this. I went to nclrights.org, and they had a lot of these good examples, and like shame therapy is basically what it is.
Well, that's really what it is. It is shame therapy.
Yeah.
I mean, at all levels of conversion therapy, there's not a conversion therapy without shame, you know, as a major element. So.
Yeah. And what some people might ask, and I think this is kind of a good segue, is that people are like, why would you go to this therapy? You know that it's bad and people have horrible experiences. Why would you go? And for a lot of people, I think it is this feeling of shame. And it could be religion-based. It could just be societal-based. This is unfortunately, let's call it like it is, this is a straight world we live in.
Yeah.
It's very oppressive to anyone that's not a white male that's straight.
I think the kind of... I mean, that's the reason you have any celebration of any other culture or subgroup. Like, that's why you have, like...
It's always out of oppression.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's out of oppression. That's why you celebrate women. That's why we celebrate the LGBTQ community, like, all that.
But all this oppression can cause this sort of shame with people, so they need to reach out, and they feel like they need to be, quote-unquote, cured.
And, you know, an interesting thing on that shame thing, I've mm-hmm. seen families that were just moderately faithful, you know, not necessarily, you know, everything by the Bible, you know, kind of evangelicals. They might even have a beer in the basement or something like that kind of family. And when their kids will, you know, admit to homosexuality or go through that kind of struggle with them, they'll actually become much more right wing as a response. And some of these organizations, and the organization that, you know, I was part of, would train the parents basically on, you know, to rid the parents of accepting language, mm-hmm. even if it was, you know, nominally accepting, like, you know, well, I don't want my son to die. They would say, well, you know, maybe you're overthinking this. It'd be better if he did, you know, but, you know, maybe not such strong ways, but they wouldn't want you to say that to your kid because that sounds encouraging.
Right.
You know, so they even shame the family. And that's something that is just gross. I mean, it really is. And it does happen. And I don't know. I think you are right. It's the society in that sense that I think that I don't have any children, but I think that parents if they have kids, and especially 10 years ago, you know, or longer ago, you know, if they were gay, you recognize that there was going to be some lifelong struggles.
Exactly. You want them to be accepted.
Yeah. And even in today's marriage equality world, there is a conservative spring that I think is somewhat dangerous going on right now.
I think worldwide. Yeah.
Aside from that, alone, you know, there's marriage equality, but not necessarily rights. Several people can still lose housing, jobs, healthcare, many of the necessary things in life just because they identify as homosexual, queer, or, you know, whatever that is, if it's off the norm. You know, most mm-hmm. states don't have protection for that.
Yeah. I just wanted to go in a couple more types of this therapy, because then I kind of want to ask what your experience was like. So, more recently, they'll have less painful but still kind of odd therapies where, like, you'll have a patient snap a rubber band on their wrist whenever they have homosexual thoughts, or they...
You're supposed to do that to quit smoking. Yeah, it's just like...
Yeah, it's like that.
Pavlov's dog, like...
You should see my callus. It's amazing. I just have an entire, like, wristband of callus from that. You know?
So there we go.
Oh, my God. Okay. I was reminded of this one with... We were talking about with societal norms, is that they will try to retrain one's societal etiquette and, like, communication skills to be more gender conformative. So they'll be like, don't talk like that and walk like this and be into these things because that's what you will be accepted of. They'd also have people have sex with the quote unquote correct gender so that they could, I guess that would bring them over to the correct side?
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know the thought process there.
I have heterosexual friends that are just as frightened as having sex with women as, you know, gay men.
That's
so
fair.
I don't know how that would work.
of course, there's always praying. And you kind of alluded to this a little bit, Matt, that a lot of these are funded by right-wing religious fundamentalists. Not all of them, of course, but a lot of them are. They're the ones that keep these running and keep them funded. Looking at you, Mike Pence.
Yeah. Straight up.
So, what type of therapies or therapy did you go through, Matt?
Sure. I was in a religious-based program. I came out to my family as a teenager and, you know, somewhat out of necessity, you know, I thought I was sneakier than I was, but I was being caught. And so, you know, my mother, who is a really wonderful person, she was, you know, deeply faith-based and has a deep faith. She was in an independent Baptist church, a fundamentalist church, mm-hmm. and she was really seeking help because, you know, according to her, you know, worldview at the time and her beliefs and stuff, you know, there was going to be a physical life of hell on earth for me, you know, just knowing how it was in a small town. And then, you know, the possible of a spiritual life of, you know, condemnation, you know, from God directly to hell, you know, in such a simple kind of way.
Right there in the Bible.
So, Yeah, so it's frightening. However, we can get back to that Bible stuff because that's what my PhD is, and I'd be glad to explain away some of those things. So that happened, and you know, I was actually having some health problems too. I'm an epileptic, and the stress of everything was getting to me, and I was having more and more seizures. And in fact, the first and only time that I kissed a girl in my entire life, I was 15 years old. It was December 17th, 1997. Oh, wow. It was right after school. I kissed her. I threw up blood, had a seizure, and was rushed to the hospital for 10 days. That actually, I might be allergic, you know, I don't even know.
That's a really good point.
That would be a medical condition, yeah.
Have you kissed a girl since?
No. Oh,
okay.
I mean,
we don't know for sure.
Sometimes at funerals and stuff, but you know, like they might have as thick of mustaches as I do, so it might not count.
That's fair.
this happens, this happened just because my life was so stressful, and you know, medication regimen wasn't so great for a kid, all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. There's so many things going on, but my life was out of control. They saw this, you know, in a spiritual way. As okay, this is what's making his life out of control. So how do we get him help? You know, talk to the local pastor. Pastors are horribly untrained. Even some of the best pastors in the nation are horribly untrained in mental health or emotional issues. And yet people take themselves and their families to them for advice so much. Yeah. And it really takes a strong pastor to say, thank you for coming to me with this. I'll walk you through this, but no, this is where you need professional clinical help in a way, you know, and there's not enough of those guys out there. They try to be miracle workers themselves, and they have all these brochures and, you know, these programs are made available to them. And so the Independent Baptist Church is very much involved with Focus on the Family kind of ministries.
Oh, sure.
So Dr. Dobson has an umbrella that did homosexual reparative or conversion therapy at the time called Exodus Ministries International.
Yep, I heard of
they
that.
Have since closed, and actually the president, former president of that, Alan Chambers, a man who said he was gay and then straight, married and everything, and now has kind of recanted some of that. Mm-hmm. He dissolved the organization because it was at 100% failure rating. And he basically just got sick of lying about it. He has a great book called My Exodus, which talks about him leaving that organization. And, you know, he had such a big change of heart on that. But unfortunately, that's decades after so much damage is done.
Yeah, I was going to say, how long do you think that went on before he was like, you know,
how many people
do you think went through that?
Well, millions. I mean, I know millions because they would have these. They have these big conventions where they would rent like, city arenas and stuff like that. They'd go to Cincinnati and rent the city arenas, and there'd be like 5,000 to 10,000 men, you know, and women struggling with this. And I say struggling. I know that the LGBTQ community who are very that were very good at accepting themselves. They hate it when religious people say, you know, someone struggles with homosexuality.
Right.
But that is the language. That is what the person in that kind of faith is feeling. They feel like that's a struggle.
Sure.
And they have to come through that, whether it's positive or negative means. And unfortunately, you know, this conversion therapy is a negative setting. I was in Love in Action, which is a group setting. It was for both adult men and teenagers. They had different programs. The Refuge program was for teenagers.
Wow.
And it was run in Memphis, Tennessee at the time. I think it started out in somewhere in California as well. But it was under the umbrella of Exodus Ministries.
Yeah.
And it was very much what you said before. It's a reconditioning. So they're kind of telling you, they're defining what ideal masculinity and ideal femininity is.
Yeah.
And where you fall on that. Now, you have to watch out because some homosexuals, you know, males are what they call hyper masculine. You know, this is like the leather bars kind of stuff. So, you know, they really had a strict, idiom of where you fell into for this and rules and all that kind of stuff. They, from the very beginning, it's humiliating. They bring you in with like your luggage and they check your underwear to see if it's too erogenous.
Wow.
If it's not, you know, if it's too boxery, is that, you know, not masculine enough? Or is, you know, if it's beyond tidy whitey, is that too, you know, sexy? You know, that kind of stuff.
Sure.
And so they go through that. They go through your music. I remember I was a classical pianist, and several of my albums, mostly any of them with French composers like Debussy or Fauré, were taken out, even though they were classical and sometimes sacred works.
If they can't pronounce it, then just throw it out.
Well, yeah. and it's one of those things that, you know, that's not what normal boys listen to.
Sure.
You know, and so... And apparently Hanson wasn't allowed either. I had a roommate that had that, so that was
wow.
That kind of dates me a bit, but still, you know, that was.
Well, if it makes any difference, no. I think
most people didn't know they were.
I did have a crush on Zach until I found out he was a boy,
right.
And I found out that I didn't like boys. But
see, Taylor's the one that normally, you know, people have that.
Yeah, people do. People really do gravitate towards Taylor because he's
kind of
like.
Even Quagmire on Family Guy, that was a running joke in the third season. but so, I mean, that's one of the things they recondition you in that sense. They define that, even at that time, they made you relive, you had to take, I think it was called a moral inventory, and you had to find what your, like worst, most heinous sexual experience was and tell this group of strangers, you know, what it was. It was like group therapy in that ascension, or that kind of, sense. However, we were instructed when listening that you don't offer any support. And actually, they even had people, later we found this out, they put people in there that and coached them on how to respond. I remember one lady told me that my experience hurt her feelings, you know, and talked about how disgusted she was because, you know, she has children and sons and to think that, you know, I would be a predator on them. And, you know, I was 15 or 16 years old.
That's a horrible thing to hear at that age.
Yeah. So, I mean, there is, you know, these things that they just have that down on how to break you.
Hey, real quick.
So, and that's the thing there. Usually the experiences were like 2 to 8 weeks, and mine was, I think, four and a half weeks.
Wow. So, like, where did you live at the time?
They had dormitories, yeah. It was an inpatient kind of facility.
Jeez, okay.
Were you able to, I mean, were they shared dormitories?
Yes, but so supervised that, you know, even the Holy Spirit couldn't inspire you to be aroused.
Because I had a friend, I won't mention his name, but he went to an addiction clinic.
Mm-hmm.
And it was supposed to be, like, similar, but just, like, in structure, where everything is super supervised, mm-hmm. and it's like a camp type thing, mm-hmm. but it's not fun. It's and he had anti-camp. More intercourse there than he had anywhere else.
Yeah.
And I just wondered if, like, same thing with prison, where there's more violence sometimes on the inside than the outside.
Yeah.
If this situation that you would be in would be, like, I guess if it depends on how well it's supervised, but I had wondered if there were situations where you could, like, get to, like, have a crush on someone in a situation like that, mm-hmm. and or in secret or something.
I'm sure those developed, yeah. But I think that the situation is so sad that, you know, arousal just becomes impossible at some point.
Yeah. I want to take a quick step back, because you said that you came from a small town, and I imagine that it was probably, there's probably a lot of religion around there, and that's probably why your mom wanted to send you there, right?
Yeah, I'm in a rural area in Pennsylvania. My town is less than 380 people.
That's tiny. That's way tinier than I imagined. So, when you were 15 at the time, did you, when your mom was like, let's go, or the pastor or whoever said, let's go, did you have any sort of resistance, or were you like, yes, I need to get this out of me, send me to this conversion therapy?
I think there was both. I was willing in a way because I also am spiritual and still am. Mm-hmm. I really thought that was going to be something that ruined my life and my relationship with God. It took a long time to get over that. I mean, even after being somewhat affirming of myself, you know, there's still doubting moments You know, sure. If I'm being entirely honest, you know, there's still those doubting moments today, you know. But I think that it's, I was definitely willing, but there is some resistance too. When you read the rules that you were sent and all that kind of stuff and what to prepare for, it's frightening. I mean, there's no human that wouldn't be frightened by it.
Yeah, I'd love to get my hand on those rules.
Yeah, maybe we can try to find them and post them on our Facebook group.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I have them anymore, but I'm trying to think. There was a documentary made about that particular place called This Is What Love and Action Looks Like, about a kid from 2015 or something like that.
Oh, wow.
Maybe it was a little bit earlier than that, but it's somewhat newer. And he may have listed the rules on his website because they started a huge, you know, like protest and everything back in the MySpace days. So
yeah. Wow.
It's been a while.
So there was part of you that was willing to go.
Well, I just wanted to say I've heard tons of horror stories, and there's a lot of controversy around the fact that sometimes it's kids that don't have a choice that go to these things, and that's a severe violation of their rights, where their parents are like, no, you have to go to this, and they don't want to go. But
that's where, you know, a lot of the controversy came from. At first, all of these programs were adults who were consenting, and you know, at some level, at first, I didn't necessarily care about that because, you know, you're in a consenting adult, you can waste your money and waste your time doing what you want. However, when you deeply look more into the programs and the people running them and the philosophies behind them, I think that we ought to offer adults protection too, because those people are vulnerable and frankly just brainwashed. And they're in a bad state when they consent to do it.
Well, there's other.
But children, you know, that's when people really started getting aware of this movement, was when they realized that parents could just sign their children in.
Yeah, I'm almost hesitant to call it child abuse, but that's kind of.
No, I'd call it child abuse
based on what they did there.
Yeah, I'm comfortable saying that.
I kind of feel like it is.
I think it would meet many of the qualifications for child abuse. Yeah, it's not healthy. And it'd be different if there was mixed reviews, but any legitimate scientific source in and outside of the United States, in the psychiatric, psychological, and even medical communities, they see, first of all, there's absolutely no change to towards the goal. As far as they've documented, no one has met the qualifications of becoming 100% heterosexual after meeting, you know, going through one of those programs. So not only does it fail that goal, it also inflicts immense amounts of damage on the individuals there.
Yeah, and I assume you mean both physical and emotional damage.
Yeah, and you know, even the programs that are not, you know, like you had mentioned before, like using, you know, shock therapy on genitals or even, you know, physical hormonal castration, that kind of stuff. You know, that is not the only physical way. I mean, some people, there are physical abuses that they commit to each other, but they become people that cut. They become self-abusive. You know, they adopt these habits of expression that are so negative and detrimental to their own health because it's one of their bodies and brains only coping mechanisms at some point, you know, after being inflicted with that.
So from what I know of your story so far, you told us about what it's actually like there. You show up, they immediately humiliate you, and they go through and decide what's masculine and feminine in your clothes and music. What was the day-to-day experience like for those 2 weeks?
Yeah, it's different forms of group therapy, that kind of stuff. You're obviously always talking about sexuality too, which, you know, it creates such an unhealthy focus of who you are as a whole. For so much of my life, I just thought of myself as homosexual, and in some ways that was really bad to me because, you know, my religious worldview, and then other times my religious worldview changed, it was fine, but that became like the whole part of me, and that's also not healthy in a way because that's not the whole part of, you know, who I am. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you're only dwelling on that, it just creates such a dark cavern and kind of like an echo of thoughts all the time. You know, you look at everything in a sexual kind of way, or human sexuality kind of way, and you know, it's like, well, God, sometimes it can just be a cigar and you can just smoke it and have fun, you know?
Yeah.
And it's okay, you know, like, you don't have to let every little thing identify you as what, you know, you don't have to fit into a pigeonhole. And that's where I think the kids today have so much more of an advantage. And I'm not that old. I'm 34. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, God, if I were 10 today, I just can't imagine how much better life, early life would have been.
Well, yeah,
you know?
I think it's taken us a long time to get to the point where we realize there's not a gender norm. Like, like you can play with dolls and also trucks, or you can dress in pink and be a boy. Like, this is surprisingly new. It's kind of embarrassing. But yeah, we're finally at this point where you can't, like, this place had, you can't have check boxes for what makes you masculine and feminine.
And that's, again, like, I think that's what gets me so depressed sometimes with just being disappointed in humanity, mm-hmm. in America specifically, because that's where I live and I love. But you've got a big movie, and this is going to date the episode, but we had Wonder Woman recently come mm-hmm. out, and there should have been, this is another superhero movie.
Yeah.
Let's judge it like another superhero movie.
Yeah.
But it is just like every angle, even the positive ones sometimes, this is like standing up for women and doing, like, I wish that we didn't have to say anything like
right.
that.
Well, we got to get to that point, and
yeah, these baby steps are painful.
Yeah.
You know, it is growing pains. But we're on such a positive trajectory.
Oh yeah.
I am concerned with the conservative spring, and I see it especially in, you know, the rural areas. I have chosen to live in rural areas. I did my education mm-hmm. At larger universities like Princeton and such, and I've chosen to come back, and I actually minister in that same community that I was born and raised in.
Wow.
And, you know, I was a victim to a hate crime even in my past ministry before I met you guys. And then, you know, I'm still ministering the same community, just in a different way and denomination. And, you know, the community itself is changing, sometimes scary, sometimes great. I am overwhelmed with the kindness of people when they really sit down and think about these issues, you know, and that's what it takes, is people to, cause it's easy to just have a belief system and to just kind of, you know, switch off and say, okay, well, gays are bad, I'm not thinking about it. But when
right.
they're confronted with homosexuality, whether it's their grandkids, whether it's me, whether it's, you know, somebody that they respect and they listen to and they think, and it's troublesome for them, and it's not easy.
Yeah. No, it's never going to be easy.
That's what we literally, that's what our episode was last
week.
And it's just how to be wrong and how to, like, reflect on things.
Yeah.
And that's the way to move forward.
And it takes time. And, you know, so many of my friends that are LGBTQ advocates are very, you know, they're almost like on the other side of that right wing. You know, they're very aggressive, and I understand where it comes from.
Mm-hmm.
And they really are fighting for their identity. But that same kind of aggression that didn't work on them from the right wingers mm-hmm. doesn't work on the right wingers from them.
Yeah.
I mean, they really need to show patience. And, you know, I interject when things become dangerous, but I know how to talk through things to get the seed going with people and to, you know, to really think about these matters, because you can't just tell them. I can't walk into their church and say, okay, you're going to be an open and accepting homosexual affirming church, you know, because that's not how it's going to go. So we talk about these verses, the context of the Bible, you know, the doctrine that came about later. We talk about even things like, you know, biblical literalism and Christianity is new. It didn't happen until the early 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
So
right
how does that, you know, change their, you know, thoughts as well, you know, because 100 years ago, that same church actually may not have thought the same things about those verses. You know, they may have been more liberal, you know, and how does that affect them? So there's all these things that we, you know, have to have in this conversation that take time. And I fear that, you know, with the way the country is going, that this population really need some loving, this more conservative, rural based, and they really need some attention, because I think it's their weight that's pushing a lot of these negative policies. A lot of people, ravenous politicians, are taking advantage of the naivety some of the rural populations.
This might be kind of a hard question to ask, and I think it's for all of us here. What do you guys think drives that? that need for these, I guess, rural people or even just the right-wingers that don't feel like homosexuality is quote-unquote right, where do you think that stems from? Besides,
I'm going to have the less... I'm going to have the less experienced answer, so I'll go first.
Yes.
That's cool. Well, you're going to blow me away.
Sorry, you said you were going to go first. Go with the less experienced, I guess.
Yeah.
Work our way up.
Work our way up, because, I don't want to go second after you. Jeez. Okay. No, but from my experience, it's so easy to tie religion to politics these days,
mm-hmm.
And to tie politics to religion based on the ways that different communities in rural areas are affected by politics and are so heavily faith-based in mm-hmm. what is right and wrong and the way that they're brought up from the people surrounding them. So if you live in a really, really tiny town and everyone that you've ever known your entire life has these certain sets of beliefs and they say, being gay is wrong, being gay is wrong, this is how you're supposed to look, this is how you're supposed to dress, you don't know anything else. And if you have an experience with a person that is like you go away to college or mm-hmm. something like that and you realize, hey, this person is trans or this person is intersex or whatever, and they're totally normal.
So, I mean, that kind of dovetails into what I wanted to say, which I feel like it's just fear.
Yeah.
It drives the most of it, is that this is not something that you've come face to face with and you're afraid of what that means for the world if there are gay people out there or something like that.
Yep.
It is fear, and it's a xenophobic kind of fear. It's an identity-based fear. These smaller areas, you know, have a very strong identity of who they are. Mm-hmm. It goes back to that Puritan ethic. It goes back to... you know, a lot of the town centers, the cultural centers for the towns are the churches.
Yeah.
And in many ways, that's good because you can create a communitarian event where you help feed each other, take care of each other. When someone dies, you're helping each other mourn. You really kind of go through the seasons of life with one another, which is really what religion is all about. But it also creates this kind of inbred thought, I'm not saying that in necessarily such a derogatory way. It's just the fact that the thoughts really don't get a chance to air out and experience in the real world. Now, this marriage of politics and the right wing or the evangelical church happened really with the Reagan era, the new Republicans. I really look back now and I see how taken advantage of the church was. The church had a very strong stance on abortion issues, and mm-hmm. they allowed their whole political ideology to be consumed by that one thing. And anytime you become myopic, it really creates such an awful and really it created a horrible beast. So they became, because of their strong views on abortion, they became associated with a party that really is pushing so much corporate greed, which is anti-Christian in every way. But they do it under the vice of family values and work ethic. And they use all this, you know, lingo that speaks to the religious people. They're like, yeah, you know, Paul did right. If you don't work, you don't eat. So welfare must be bad. It's like, well, that's not really. I mean, I don't think the Apostle Paul would go to Capitol Hall and say, stop feeding poor people. And even, you know, the abortion issue we know is much more complex than, you know, yes or no. They have forced people to be on these sides of things. I remember when I was a child, talking to how less divisive the politics were. Al and Tipper Gore were actually heroes of my church at one point because they were pushing for censorship in heavy metal rock and roll.
Yeah, we talked about that with Cody Blue.
So that was actually the person that stood up against that was D. Snyder, who was one of the first people.
Oh, cool.
And
yeah,
we talked to his son about it.
Yeah.
So you're talking like in 1988 to 1992, Al Gore was a beautiful, you know, family value, you know, conservative man, you know,
yeah.
And then just 10 to 15 years later, he saw by so many of them as the devil, and not just because he likes the earth, you know, like, you know, hey, maybe we should value our resources, which also sounds very godly to me, but they've been so, you know, twisted in this way that everything that comes out of any liberal's mouth has to be, you know, from Satan himself.
Well, I also want to say, I almost feel like they're cherry picking their ideals to fit what they've, I don't even know where it comes from, because there's so many people out there, this is kind of getting off topic, but like people that don't think global warming is real, so let's just treat the earth however capitalism wants it to. I don't understand where that comes from, but then they pick and choose different things to support their ideology.
They're so dead set on a 6-day literal creation story that's given in the first chapters of Genesis, mm-hmm. but then they skip over that verse immediately after that that says, you know, where God, you know, charges Adam to be the maintainer, the caretaker of earth and all that's on it.
Cherry picking, yeah.
Yeah, in that sense. And I don't think that there's, like, a businessman that walks into the church and like, hey, I got my whiteout in my back pocket. I'm going to get rid of this part. But I do
actually,
think...
Actually, I think there might have been at some point. Honestly, I think that the GOP politicians that were particularly of an Ayn Rand kind of philosophy,
mm-hmm. yeah.
I think that they are very manipulative, and they have been successful in using faith as their weapon, because the men themselves don't come across as that faithful. I mean, you have some people like Ted Cruz, who obviously is very much inside the evangelical kind of realm, and, you know, he speaks the talk, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But I'm not so sure that people, you know, like Paul Ryan, you know, wake up each morning and, you know, are really looking for God's love to infuse.
I think they
are good at manipulating the church. You know, they're the ones who, you know, I find it appalling that churches support the NRA, but many of them do. And it's like, mm-hmm. well, geez, you know, and I'm fine with people having their, you know, own thoughts on rifles and all that kind of stuff. But to use religion in a way, especially a book that, you know, didn't have guns to speak in a way positive of guns seems kind of weird to me. You know? Like, if anything, you should just be ambivalent.
Did we read the same Bible? Because I remember Jesus getting them rifles out.
He had an AK-47.
That's true.
Right?
That's another Family Guy episode, right? Him and Moses attacking,
yeah,
you know.
As soon as he took the gun away, he said, well, I mean, I could give it back, but you have access to healthcare. He just starts spitting.
Right. He's like, how am I supposed to protect my homestead?
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
How am I supposed to protect my tomb?
And those kind of things, you know, when we were talking about the identities of these small towns, you know, homosexuality is an identity thing. And so many people are uncomfortable with coming to terms with their own identity, even in a heterosexual way. I remember as a child, you know, those awful pre-sex ed classes you have, like, in sixth grade. Oh, you know, yeah. I remember one of my friends writing down the question of, you know, like, what if I have dreams where I'm attracted to another boy or something like that?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I remember the teacher, you know, I remember knowing what my friend's question was. I remember knowing what the paper looked like. I remember the teacher looking at that question and putting it on the bottom of the pile, you know, just because...
They just want to face it?
They're not dealing with it, you know?
Yeah.
And that's one of those things now where, I mean, most mature people who can come to some grips with their own identity realize that sexuality is on a spectrum.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a preference, but, you know, it's still a spectrum. Well, these people are black and white, you know, nope, I'm straight and, you know, gay is bad. And it's one of those things that it just wrecks them to come to terms with maybe the world's much more grayer than we really think.
In all senses, yeah. I guess even... I think the most offensive would be, like, white cisgender males, like us, to say, not us particularly, because we're open to the idea of a spectrum. Like, that's how it is. That's the truth. That's facts. That gender is a spectrum, and that's why we wanted to cover things like this and, like...
Mm-hmm. And even historically confirmed, I mean, throughout many cultures, and even biblically, I mean, so we don't have really much reason to believe that David was a flat-out homosexual in the Bible. However, David does say, I love Jonathan more than I love any woman, and more than I ever could love any woman.
Yeah, that's
and amazing. At a pinnacle point in his in that biblical story, David and Jonathan, you know, hold each other throughout the night, crying, and, you know, they kiss. Now, there's a lot of cultural things going on. You know, there's no reason that we have to take that in an erogenous or erotic kind of way. But at the other point of it, it does open up a beautiful image of what, you know, that ancient society saw. Like, David could be a king, he could be a poet, he could be a warrior, mm-hmm. he could have affairs with women, and he could love a man more than he loved any woman. And yeah. that's all in the book, and that's fine. You know?
Yeah.
And yet today, we can't come to those conclusions. You know?
I think that's a perfect point to bring up, because at some point in history, it just became a crime to not be straight. Putting it blankly is that eventually we just started imprisoning people or putting them in mental institutions for this. And before that, there's plenty of civilizations, like ancient Greece was very open to sexuality. Like, if you were aroused by something, you
go
acted
it.
On it.
Yeah.
It didn't matter.
Yeah.
And there's plenty of civilizations like that, and it's...
And you wrote a play about it, and your mom might have been blinded, you know?
Right.
Right.
These things happen.
Yeah. It's just another day in ancient Greece.
Well, and they do use the Bible so rigidly. Like I said, you know, it wasn't... A literalist take on reading the Bible is very new. You know, mm-hmm. it's something that came about, and actually, hard to believe this now, but at Princeton University or Princeton Theological Seminary, it came about, you know, in America through the Presbyterian Church, and they come up with what they call the fundamentals of faith, meaning that you had to believe these things to be a true Christian, and that's where we get our Christian fundamentalists from, and a lot of that is a biblical literalist point of view. Now, the Old Testament has, you know, there's 9 verses in the Bible entirely that can be looked about on homosexuality. The first that are the most blatant come in the Levitical Holiness Code. And that's where it flat out says, you know, if a man shall not lie with a man like he lies with a woman, this is an abomination before God.
Well, now, so you just can't lay in the bed, so you can go elsewhere, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
I've never laid with a woman, so I don't even know what that, you know.
Right.
So, and as far as I know, that means seizing and puking. So I, you know, and I've never done that with a man.
Yeah.
So, but you know, I think that, you know, that word abomination is an English word, and the Hebrew word itself actually meant not ritually right. It didn't mean morally repugnant. It didn't mean, you know, these things that we add meaning to today.
Sure.
It just meant that this is not ritually pure in the Jewish context. And there was reasons for the Holiness Code. They were in an area of people that looked like them, talked like them, mm-hmm. Had the same pantheon of gods, and they were evolving as their own people. How do you do that? Well, you start looking different. You start acting different. Mm-hmm. You start, you know, these things, you know, come about in that way. And that's where that came from. Even Sodom and Gomorrah, the, you know, kind of the quintessential God-destroying homosexuality story itself, you know, later on, the prophet Ezekiel tells exactly what that is. He goes, you know, God punished the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah because of inhospitality. And hospitality was such a huge part of the Middle Eastern culture at that time, so much so that if you were, you know, a traveler, the cities were your only refuge because you were in deserts and it was harsh environments. So it was an ethical expectation that cities take you in. If you read the story of Sodom and Gomorrah, you go back and you see these two visitors that may be angels, depending on how you read into it, go to Abraham. And Abraham sends them to Sodom and Gomorrah, and Sodom and Gomorrah won't take them. So Abraham brings them into Lot. And at that point, they're really being accosted because their visitors in Sodom and Gomorrah stopped taking in visitors. Well, this was an ethical violation, so God punished the city in, you know, in that simplest of terms. You know, obviously there probably was not really a Sodom and Gomorrah, and there probably was not sulfur and lightning and all that kind of stuff. It's a nice little tale to tell us God wants us to take care of each other.
Yeah.
And if you don't, there's probably consequences.
Right? Yeah, it's so easy to twist that.
That story has been just it's become an abomination itself.
and even in the New Testament, you know, when Paul is writing all this stuff, you know, there's words that in Greek, they're not using the standard words for like homosexual. One, because there was not a homosexual caste. There were not people like me today that that sought to be in relationship with people of the same sex. I mean, the cultural times were different. So, you know, many of them were married and had, you know, either a pederastical relationships, you know, or different things that were culturally suitable at that time.
It's interesting.
And that was those, you know, or with slaves or all that kind of stuff. Well, Paul's addressing that a bit and saying, you know, you want to keep marriage pure and you want to do, you know, these certain kind of things. And again, it became like a Christian holiness code. These Greeks that were becoming to the coming to the Christian church, you know, they were still Greeks. So how do you separate yourself from your old culture? You know, you start to look different and start to do things a little different. I can't imagine that the Apostle Paul or any of the authors, you know, that if they really existed and really wrote the books in this way, would come to someone's church today and say, "Oh my gosh, your nephew Timmy's gay. We got to tie him down to a chair and make him look at violent gay sex."
Yeah.
Like, I can't imagine any of that would be warranted by those people. And if so, then what an awful, what an awful, you know, religion that we've found ourselves in. But
that's fair.
But it's not, you know, it's there's so much more, you know, to it that just people have to come to terms with and walk themselves through.
People can't ignore that. And that's exactly what they're doing. They're just ignoring those parts that don't jive with their belief system.
It's almost like they have cognitive dissonance.
Yeah.
Come full circle.
Well, it is a lot cognitive dissonance, yeah.
Okay, so where are we today on this issue? And how do we stop conversion therapy from happening today?
Sure. The good news, like I said, is this large organization, Exodus, which was under the umbrella of Focus on the Family by Dr. James Dobson, it has dissolved entirely. They have been very forthright and admitted their errors. Most of the people that were, high up in those organizations have actually become advocates for LGBTQ faith inclusion.
Good.
Alan Chambers is one of those men. I had a lot of trouble with him, to be honest, because as a kid and even as a college student, you know, and I still, I hate to have hatred inside of me, but I have a lot of hatred inside of me for him just because of the things I've heard, saw him say, you know, the organization, the pain that caused.
That's fair.
I've come to I talked to him this morning on Facebook and said, "Hey, I'm going to be on a little podcast this afternoon. And, you know, I just want to say, you know, thank you for changing. Thank you for being honest. Thank you for thinking through this." And he sent me a very, you know, lovely message back. And so that's the good news. Those guys are on board. People are talking about this more. The bad news is this is still going on. It's still legal in many states. Some states are coming to conclusions where they are actually banning it as a form of therapy in general. Many other states have become much more firm, saying if you're going to call it therapy, you better meet all Department of Health care codes, which, you know, they obviously can't. So that has shut down a lot of them kind of in a, you know, de facto way. The really bad news is the ones that are still out there are serious. They're more intensive. And the leader's more ravenous. There is a the school of thought behind Dr. Nicolosi. He is a very fundamentalist Roman Catholic on the right wing side. His writings are ravenous, and his followers and adherents to his conversion therapy are very dangerous. And
that's the frightening stuff.
And they have connections with our current Department of Education secretary.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
All of that. So they have ways in, and we really have to be cautious of that. And they are looking for any opportunity, semantics, anything that allows them a little bit of room. So it's very important that we force our politicians to be clear, transparent, and authentic on these kind of issues, and to not allow them to have subtlety in their speech. You know, we want to ask them, you know, straight out things like, is this, you know, religious-based conversion therapy? If it's not, if it's scientific-based, who is the, you know, journal of academics that are criticizing this work? Yeah, exactly. How is this, you know, being reported to the Federal Drug Administration, to the local departments of health, all of that kind of stuff? I do caution, you know, because I sometimes I get so passionate about this stuff that I just want to rip people's heads off. Patience is so necessary with people that are struggling on both sides, whether they're coming to conclusions about their own identity. I mean, when someone comes out of the closet to you, that is a beautiful moment And it's so often ruined by religious people because they just say, well, crap, you know, this is the end of the world for you, or, you know, I'd rather you were dead. And that's one of those things where we have to be cautious of, but we also have to be cautious with, you know, the religious people that are struggling through these issues in a real way, because they need time. And if they're not being harmful in a way that is really directly causing injury to somebody, give them as much time as possible to think through these things, you know, provide them with ample evidence and, you know, do it in a kind way, because they're going to end up changing the world with their thoughts as well.
Yeah. I think you hit it on the head with patience is pretty much the only tool we have.
Yeah. Well, it's in this specific situation, I think so. In some
patience
situations, like, I embrace my anger and I think I'm going to fight this because
be productive with it.
Right. And be productive to make a positive change in something like a political stance, where if I try to meet someone that disagrees with me on the middle ground, sometimes we're not going to get there. So I'm going to outvote you.
Yeah, and sometimes that needs to happen. Like, if there was, you know, violence going on, and it was a real immediate threat, I would fly right down with you guys and march, protest, and kick butt. You know, I'm a big guy. I'm 6'3" and 270 pounds, and you know, I'm not afraid to put some fisticuffs if it has to happen. But yeah, the people really need to work through these issues, and the world is expanding so fast in these rural areas because of, you know, the exposure to even TV channels and internet and
Internet's
stars.
Internet's pretty new,
huh? Yeah.
What's this dialogue thing?
So, I mean, there's just these things that, and there is so much, in fact, I've shared your episode on fake news with so many people because, because they need to know, you know, and so many of them will quote these sources and it's like, well, let's go back to that source. Oh, that, you know, like, they're naming Indiana Jones as an editor. I don't know if that's really a great place to start, you know?
Yeah.
So it's keeping informed and up to date with the most current research, you know, that's available. And you can live a faithful life and be LGBTQ. There's lots of churches and denominations that allow for that. There's people like me that are involved in denominations that are on their way, but we're still fighting. And, you know, eventually the denominations of Christianity that don't see, you know, the importance of the diversity in their flock with LGBTQ individuals, they're probably going to die out because just, I mean, the world's coming to a conclusion here where we can say, nah, you're wrong, and, you know, we love people, and that seems much more godly than what you're saying.
So, again, tying that to politics, because a lot of this is that.
Well, it's just the climate that we're in.
It's the climate we're in. So what I'm trying to get at in this is I'm a Young Turks member. I know Nick loves Young Turks too. One thing's Cenk.
And I'm Turkish.
And you're Turkish. Yeah. So it all ties together. One of the things they say is we're going to win eventually. It just depends on how quickly we get there.
Yeah.
As a progressive, the world's becoming more progressive, but how long is it going to take for people to be more accepting? And it comes down to getting these rural communities to experience other cultures and to see other things.
That comes down to knowledge. Mm-hmm. And I am a firm believer that the best thing you can do is have the knowledge yourself and try to spread it as best as you can.
Yeah. And beyond hanging out, that's one of the main reasons we do the show.
Yeah, just to spread that knowledge. I'm trying to think if I have any last questions. Has anyone ever come to you, because what's your status in the clergy?
I am a associate pastor at this time, with a rural co-op of churches. So I work with 6 churches in the area.
So has anyone ever come to you and said, hey, I want to go to a conversion therapy. What are your thoughts?
No. I don't think that they would necessarily, just because, you know, they know me and how I speak and all that kind of thought.
Sure.
They have... I've had a few, you know, families deal with those sexuality issues and talk to me about how they deal with their kids and stuff. And they've worked out pretty well in general. I mean, it's a struggling, being a teenager and a parent of teenagers looks frightening anyways,
yeah.
Whether they're gay, straight, or anything. Yeah, so, I mean, it, you know, be prepared. It looks like it's going to be, you know, horrifying. So.
Trust but, me, you know. Everybody wake up screaming, so. Right.
So they go through these, you know, we walk through these issues together. Mm-hmm. And I think that's important as well as, you know, so long homosexuality was hidden and the community was robbed of the opportunity to grow with the family on that. And I'm such a communitarian person in a way that, and especially in these rural towns, we're in it together. So, you know, if someone is having identity issues, you know, whether it's homosexual, they're coming to terms with that, or transgendered, or, you know, even, you know, whatever it may be, let's walk through this together, because our mutual experience is going to help, you know. Yeah. And it's going to be what steers the ship in the best direction.
Yeah, learn from each other. Don't be afraid of that.
And also there's peace in numbers. When you do everything quietly, you can find a lot of aggression and fear winning, because you don't talk things out.
That's
you don't,
a good point.
You know, yeah. So if everything is so hidden, it becomes troublesome. But if you can really create an environment where people feel comfortable being honest with you and authentic, which means that you have to take away all punitive, you know, kind of, vibes. If you can do that, because that's what we're asking people to do with God anyways, right? We're saying you need to be honest with God. You need to be honest with your spiritual self. You need to rise above any kind of issue that you may be having.
Yeah.
Well, you can't do that if they're afraid of being punished, you know, at every sense. And Christianity has a beautiful soteriological message of grace, and that's unconditional love in an unmerited form. Well, if the church isn't exemplifying that, then you can't expect your people to actually be Christians. And that's when we get all these weird hateful spikes within our churches and communities.
I think that's a beautiful way to put it. Yeah. Like not being honest is, and being oppressive is not very Christian.
Yeah, and not productive in a general human way either, yeah. In a human secularist way. So.
I have two last questions. And
I'll try to be shorter. I'm sorry.
No,
I
you're
kind of
fine.
Rattle on.
I love this information.
It's gonna be like the Lord of the Rings of reparative therapy.
It'll be 12 hours of the extended cut. Do you want to do a quick break to plug our dumb stuff?
Yeah, let's do that.
So we're gonna take a quick break to tell people where to find us. You can find us at StrangerStillShow.com.
Yep, you could go to facebook.com/groups/StrangerStillShow
and leave us a review on iTunes.
We're trying to get to 2,000 reviews.
And we're at 33.
Yep.
So leave us a review. Matt, do you have any like places people can go to show their support for the LGBTQ community that you favor?
Sure. I am really in love with the idea of reconciling ministries in the United Methodist churches. They're great. And, I thought you said no Methodist. I'm like,
I was raised a Methodist, so.
Oh, great. And Methodist church, you know, they're having their own struggles with this. There's more conservative belts and there's more liberal and progressive belts, but Reconciling Ministries is a great, group that will go in and talk with church leaders and church laity and speak truth about these issues, both biblically and scientifically, and allow churches to issue support and become open and accepting for the LGBTQ and the community. And I do have to say that, you know, when I was a victim of a hate crime and I left my one ministry, I was going to walk away from Christianity, and it was awful because it was such a deep part of who I am.
Yeah.
And the identity of who I am. So anytime I can find a church that is really looking to be safe, and even if they don't understand everything or can't, you know, condone is such a weird word, but, you know, condone everything, if they're willing to talk and be safe and just not throw people out, that's amazing, and especially in these rural areas and the Bible Belt and all of that. So Reconciling Ministries is a great organization for
cool.
that.
Cool. Yeah, we'll definitely put some links up.
Absolutely.
On our site for that.
I was gonna say we're going to blast them all over the place. And not, like, put them on blast. Like, we're going to just paste their stuff all over our page.
And then also a young progressive minister. His name is Brandon Robertson. He's coming out of the Moody Bible Institute tradition, which is very evangelical, traditionalist. And he's doing a lot of good work. He wrote a book called Nomad, talking about his spiritual journey in LGBTQ lifestyle and progressive evangelical faith. And then finally, the last would be the Uncommon Good Collective, which is run by my friend Michael Kempin, formerly of the Marin Foundation. And basically, they intersect where faith and sexuality speak, and they're assisting in those areas in many creative ways that allow people to kind of come on board.
I love it. Cool. I have two last questions. This one's really short. On a scale from 1 to 10, 1 being like a day at the theme park and 10 being like being shot into space without a spacesuit and suffocating to death, how bad was conversion therapy?
You know, it's really hard to answer on this side because I do think that I have enveloped myself a little bit from that experience. I think that there's like a dome over the PTSD of that all. And so in many ways it made me who I am now, mm-hmm. but it killed so many people. I mean, literally killed so many people that I really did love. And when I read their stories, you know, even love them more, you know, posthumously. And so, yeah, I would say 2.
Okay. That's a lot lower than I thought it would be.
Well, I think it's not as nuanced. It's more gray.
wait, was 2 the... 1 was spacesuit dying, right?
No, that was 10.
Oh, sorry, so 9.
Okay, perfect.
Okay, cool. Yeah, good. Yeah.
1 was
flip it for
park,
real.
Right?
Yeah, flip it for real. Yeah, sorry.
And then my last thing is, what would you say to someone who is out there struggling, as we will call it, struggling with identity or... oppression in today's society?
Sure. Well, the first thing is allow yourself room to struggle. And that goes with any issue, but you need space. Homosexuality is not always cut and dry for people. I mean, I know some of my friends that I've worked with, you know, they've known, you know, and they were perfectly fine. They came out. Everybody was supportive. You know, life was great. Mm-hmm. I knew... you know, that was homosexual when I was 5. I mean, I remember feeling this in church and knowing, you know, wow. Like, oh, this is over, you know, like I remember as a 5-year-old having that, like, this is the end of it kind of feeling.
That's scary.
Yeah, it really was horrifying. And it takes time. And there's still elements of my identity that I would struggle with today. And I think that's healthy to do, you know, give yourself space, surround yourself by people that are loving and supporting. They don't have to agree with you, you know, and that's great to kind of have people that don't necessarily agree with you, but that are loving and supporting ultimately. I mean, my friends make a lot of boneheaded decisions, but I don't throw them out. And, you know, and it's important to just be around people and thank God that there's a culture now that exists, you know, that you can connect with. You can go to pride that's rallies. Point, yeah. There's PFLAG things. There's... you know, when I was a kid, there was Danny who was gay on MTV's Real World. And I would just fantasize about, you know, that experience, you know. Yeah. And you know, because it was him or Paul Lynde and Liberace. That was it. You know? And now there's, you know, a plethora of positive gay role models, you know, that are just living out there and changing the world.
Yep. I love it.
I think their presence.
We can't, like... That's it. We can't do anything better than that.
I got nothing else to say. Do you got anything else to say, guys? Nothing?
Nothing.
All right. Well,
I think I spoke entirely too much, so.
No.
No.
I love
this
it.
We wanted to put you in the driver's seat. Like, it's Pride Month.
Yeah.
We want to be better allies. But we're 2 white cisgendered males.
Say, we are not the people to talk about this, and that's why we wanted to.
So we said, let's get someone who is a member of that community to speak.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah,
and from the community, I do want to thank you as well for being allies and for being outspoken allies and, you know, not only celebrating Pride Month on your podcast, and, you know, the Facebook group and talking about it. But I also know in your own personal lives, like, you know, you're supportive of, you know, your gay friends and your lesbian friends and your trans friends and intersex friends. And that's important because, you know, we are a minority just because of the way that, you know, it's homosexuality is complex. So, but we can say that there's some genetic mapping, you know, that's pretty obvious. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that genetic mapping makes us a minority. So we need the help and support of, you know, loving allies that are not going to allow us to be kicked around. So it's great to, you know, that you guys are really doing that in real life too.
Yeah.
Well,
we're here for you.
I wish we could do more.
And even in fake life, it's good, you know?
I said, hell yeah. I can't say that after all this.
Oh, after. Okay. Well, I think that'll do it for this week.
Yeah.
I'm still Nick.
I'm still John.
I've always been Maddie, so I don't know.
And this has been Stranger Still.